Hello and welcome to Androids and Assets. I'm Marshall.
And I'm Steven.
Today we have our guest, Olev Rockne, from the Hugo Club blog, the hugoclub.blogspot.ca, renowned science fiction commentator. You might recognize him from works such as the list of unions in science fiction.
And the list of failed adaptations of Hugo-nominated works. We have that list going as well. That one is actually a lot of work. Did you know that they actually adapted a short story by Connie Willis into a Christmas movie, for example? I swear exists. And the High Crusade by Paul Anderson got turned into a movie, and it's terrible.
I mean, there are a lot of bad movies that get made.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. A lot of bad movies based on classic sci-fi novels. But that's not what I'm here to talk about.
No, today we're here to talk about the representation of organized labor in science fiction. On one of our recent episodes, we were talking about Wired's series of The Future of Work, and Stephen made the point that the Hugo Club blog had a great couple of essays about organized labor and unions and the representation of unions in science fiction, and we thought let's get Olev in here and we'll talk about how that list came about and
sorry if I may interject, and if you do not mind me taking this off on a weird direction. You're talking about the absence of labor in the Wired's The Future of Work issue. That was only 8 stories. Now, the two of us both recently read the short story collection People's Future of the United States by John Joseph, edited by Victor Laval and John Joseph Adams. And while it is a very interesting collection that has modeled itself on Howard Zinn's A People's History of the United States, I'm going to be a little critical of it in that, again, not a single one of those stories tackled unions. And I actually went back to A People's History because I actually thought to myself, I thought there was union stuff in A People's History. There is. There's plenty of union stuff in A People's History. There's, you know, probably a third of the book is strikes and workers organizing, and yet, and it's specifically because Zinn noticed that those stories were not being told. And while a lot of neglected demographics and ideas were tackled in A People's Future, I was kind of shocked that, again, labor gets the short shrift in science fiction.
So I think I'm particularly interested in how you got interested in this topic, because you seem knowledgeable about it, and you've written a few posts about it, and you've got some of this like trivia about it. But how did you get onto this initially?
Okay, so I used to work for the Alberta Federation of Labor, which is the labor central here in Alberta, and one of the labor studies professors at the University of Athabasca was working on a paper on the intersection between labor and science fiction. And since this might surprise you, but people know that I'm a nerd about science fiction. And so just in passing conversation, Dr. Barnetson did ask me, could I think of any examples? And I wasn't actually able to help him on that. And he wrote this fantastic paper, this really interesting paper called Resistance is Futile on the Underrepresentation of Labor in Science Fiction, which he co-authored with Mark McCutcheon. And after he published that about 5 years ago, I kept thinking about the subject. It's a really brilliant paper, and it only covers about the period of, you know, the 1990s and the early aughts. Really in-depth analysis. Highly recommend it if you have the time to read it. It looks at 9 texts. And ever since they did that paper, I've been sort of jotting down every reference to labor unions that I saw in science fiction. So this last summer, I had the chance to expand that into a group discussion at Worldcon. And I mean, the people on that panel, Cory Doctorow, Patrick Nielsen Hayden and Eric Flint, they all had some really great ideas that just left me really enthusiastic and inspired to put some of my thoughts and their thoughts down into this longer series of articles.
I was lucky enough actually to be at Worldcon and see that panel. And it was amazing. Unfortunate that a couple of the other panelists had to pull out at the last minute, but still the three that were there, yeah. Really engaging discussion.
Well, Eileen Gunn has written about these kinds of things in her work, and unfortunately she was ill, and Annalee Newitz, I would have loved to have heard her thoughts on the subject, because she's written about labor-related subjects in her work, so...
Yeah.
Autonomous is like, yeah, it's pretty central.
Yeah, even in Autonomous, as much as labor is central, I don't remember seeing...
Oh, there is no organizing of workers in there. But it is about subversion of workers' rights,
absolutely.
Which is a related subject.
Certainly, 100%. And so the panel was really great, sort of talking about, I know it touched on... Margaret Thatcher saying, like, there's no alternative to this neoliberal order that sort of was rising up.
That was Doctorow's observation, and it was really, like, totally on point.
For sure. And saying, you know, like, it's science fiction's job to imagine alternatives to basically everything. So that includes organizing or not organizing labor.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think we're getting into now kind of, like, why this matters, why this is important, because I think there's a real danger in this narrative that's being promulgated about, you know, in the future work, what work will exist, first of all, and then second of all, that somehow through, like, this, you know, ease of financial intercourse and production and automated production will migrate away from the historicity of the struggle of labor and the struggle of class.
Yeah, we can only achieve futures that we can imagine. And by failing to imagine alternatives, mainstream classic science fiction has been complicit in the supremacy of unfettered neoliberal capitalism. And what?
No, I don't disagree. It's just like it's a very bold statement.
Yes. It might surprise people to find out that the lot of us here have views on these matters that might be described potentially as left of center.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I know I hide it well.
People will be shocked to find out that we're leftist.
But our Antifa terror cell will strike any day.
we've all seen Ready Player One here.
Unfortunately.
Yes. Yeah. And Reddit.
And Reddit.
Yep.
Yeah. And I'm just going to use this as an example of this.
As a straw man.
As a straw man, yes. There's so much to criticize about it. But the thing that hasn't been criticized yet, or at least I haven't seen criticized, is how it totally buys into this idea of workers' rights will not exist in the future. There is no point struggling, and the only way to lift yourself up from poverty and being destitute is to win the lottery, or to have a heroic narrative. It isn't about.
I think we said that. I think.
We might have. It wouldn't surprise me. Anyway.
Yeah, but I mean, it comes time and time again. It's Neuromancer. The only way out is. You know, the heroic narrative. It isn't through solidarity or working with his compatriots. And I mean, that's a book I like, but
yeah, there is a lot of focus in a lot of writing on the hero's journey, one person or a small group of people rising up against something, you know, and they save a lot of people, but they're not doing it through organized action, class consciousness sort of thing. It's like, well, we know what's good for you, and so we'll overthrow this other tyranny.
And actually, again, to bring this back to Bob Barnetson and Mark McCutcheon's work, they actually point out in their paper how the converse story is that groups that work collectively are portrayed very negatively. Like, collectivization is really antithetical to most heroes in science fiction. So we're talking the Borg, we're talking the pod people, we're talking the Daleks. It's the moment that people are working collectively, or beings are working collectively, they are less human. So it's an argument that unfortunately I am not going to be able to do justice to in the retelling, because that paper is so good.
So in the course of looking into all of this, what was something that that surprised you?
There were a couple of things. One of the biggest surprises for me was that other than the McCutcheon and Barnetson paper, very little had been written on the subject of labor in science fiction. Like, my partner Amanda Walkruck, who is an academic librarian, helped me do a literature search on this, and basically nothing comes up. I mean, there's some tangentially related research into workplaces, but almost nothing about collective action or the idea of worker organizing in science fiction. So it is a subject that is rife for further inquiry. And, you know, we've gotten a lot of feedback on this article, and I think there is a hunger for more thinking in this area. I mean, there's Adam Ricunas, who wrote Windswept. He wrote an article about labor in science fiction, and it's good. But again, it focuses on individual workers rather than collective action.
Mm-hmm. So if there's any like graduate students, maybe in like English or
cultural studies or labor studies,
Complete.
Or comparative literature or even economics or, you know, just anybody doing academic work that could touch on this, please do. There's a hunger for it.
Yeah, you will become almost immediately the expert in the field by writing, you know, any... If you write two papers on this...
Everybody's writing theses about Buffy the Vampire Slayer these days. So just, you know, talk about why the Double Meat Palace needs to be unionized. There. You've got your thesis.
Done. Yeah, absolutely. So you have been doing some writing on this. So like, is this going to become a recurring part on the blog, a recurring thing? In 7 years, we'll have part 96 of labor unions and science fiction.
I don't think so. You know, I started out just planning to do one blog, and then one blog turned into a blog and a list. And then that blog post, the draft got longer and longer, and I had to split it into two. And then part two kept dragging out, and suddenly I needed to hive something off. And the only thing I could do was to break off the movies and television. So it has been growing. And I mean, there might be another post or two in this for me. One of the people who was criticizing this, actually, a guy named Robert Wood, he was pointing out a number of examples in science fiction that are about workers acting collectively, but it's not described as a union. It's more a radical economic self-organization. And, I mean, he gave examples like the Mars Trilogy by Kim Stanley Robinson, Joanna Russ's The Female Man, and he's right. He's right that this is a whole other segment of labor organizing that could be talked about. And could be compared actually to the industrial workers of the world, the Wobblies. And I think that's another rich subject to talk about. But do I have an appetite to do this for years on end? I don't think so. And I don't know how many more blog posts after that there's room for. Certainly it's going to be a focus when I'm reviewing any book, or if I see unions in science fiction again, I think it's going to be worth talking about, but I don't think it can be a recurring subject.
Sure, yeah. Now that you've had the scales removed from your eyes, you'll be looking for unions everywhere that you read about.
And I hope others are as well.
So you mentioned before you got some feedback. What's the reaction been to this? Like, because you have actually a fairly widely read blog.
I don't know how widely read, but this series has gotten a very good reaction. A lot of people have written in to tell me exactly why I'm wrong. And what's nice about that is how many of the people writing in have been very critical, but in constructive and thoughtful ways. Like, you know, that Robert Wood, who I was mentioning, a guy named Eli, they are pointing out on my list of science fiction, there were a couple of entries that were either slightly inaccurate. Like I described, a union's representation as mixed rather than positive. And they were saying, oh, no, no, this is more of a positive depiction. And I hadn't read the book in 15 years, so yeah, I may have misremembered. But there have been one or two anti-union trolls writing in, and it's very easy to dismiss those two. And when I say two, I mean, yeah, just two. And a lot of people writing in with, additional suggestions. Somebody posted some old-time radio episode from the 70s that there's no chance I would have ever listened to. And it's got a negative depiction of a union in it, but it's a very specific piece. You know, the people over at File 770, I sent them, Mike Glyer, the editor over there, links to this blog. He gave us a nice signal boost. And the readership over there, they had some fantastic thoughts and criticisms of this. A lot of people have said they don't really love my criticism of Isaac Asimov, but I think it's fair.
You have had Asimov's.
Yeah, I love Asimov. I love Asimov, but I mean, I can't be blind to the fact that on this particular subject, he was kind of
Asimov was a reactionary, like politically. It seems pretty clear. I don't know. I feel
he was very progressive on some things. You know, Asimov has a reputation for being progressive on a lot of things because he was progressive. It's just when it comes to work and workers, he's talking about the robot, and he's really radically misinterpreted Carol Capek's original intent of what the robot was supposed to represent. Capek introduced the robot in Rostrum's Universal Robots, and it's a metaphor for the downtrodden worker. They rise up.
Robot literally means slave, right? It's the Czech word for slave.
It's the Czech word for slave. And the entire thing is these, you know, self-aware beings who are forced to do work end up rising up to assert their workplace rights. And then by the time Asimov takes this metaphor, he's got the robot as a happy slave. It is kind of distressing to think that this is a slave narrative.
Well, I've said it before and I'll say it again. The three laws of robotics are basically like robot Jim Crow. So
yeah. And you know, when Asimov was writing the robot stories, there were people alive who remembered slavery. Like, this is only 60 something years after the Civil War. So some of the readers of these stories, having a servile being at your beck and call, isn't a matter of futurism. Some of these stories weren't being read as futurism. They were being read as nostalgia.
And I think if you read it that way, and you sort of have this idea that Asimov did of like, oh, science and progress, and we're going to have these machines that'll do all the work for us, it sort of makes sense that you wouldn't have a workers' union anymore, because you pretty much don't have workers anymore. Like, you have at least human workers. You don't have human workers anymore. So it's hard to imagine these people getting them all together is like a CEO club. Like, it's a golf club, not a union.
Yeah, or, you know, some information workers, like, you know, Gal Dornick, he joins the faculty at the University of Trantor, but there's no discussion of a faculty association or how they make sure that they have workplace rights in that instance, which I still think might be worthwhile, even in a city-sized plant or a planet-sized city.
So I'm hearing some disappointment there then with the state of science fiction, and I feel that's a similar disappointment, I think. So, like,
yeah, not a lot had been written about science, labor unions in science fiction prior to about 1980. It was surprisingly barren when I was looking for analysis of this, and I sort of went into this reading of past science fiction with an expectation to find benign neglect. You know, I thought maybe Heinlein might be anti-union because, you know, Heinlein. But I was kind of surprised to find generalized hostility towards labor unions in basically every piece of science fiction that I examined prior to about 1980. There are some notable exceptions. Larry Niven makes some positive remarks, but I mean, I was really surprised to find Asimov was as anti-union as all of that. And it comes up in Foundation, his robot novels. It comes up in a story called Strikebreaker, where, spoiler alert, the hero is the guy who's breaking the strike. And so there was a lot of disappointment for me in that. Alec Navalli, the author of the recent really excellent biography of John W. Campbell, he actually helped inform me of a letter that John W. Campbell Jr., the famous editor, he wrote to H. Beam Piper, the author of Little Fuzzy, about labor unions and how he didn't like unions, but didn't want his stories to reflect that because he felt beholden to the printers' union. He was afraid of his printers' union. That's the only reason why there was less negativity towards unions than...
It was a hostile truce between the writer, the bourgeoisie writers, and the labor unions at the printers.
Yeah, yeah. And I think Eric Flint, at that panel in the summer, he pointed out that a lot of writers of the day, the sort of hoi polloi, highbrow writers, didn't see themselves as working class, even though they worked for a living, because they were, you know, creative types. So they did not identify with the struggles of the proletariat.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, even you have guys like, you know, Jack Vance, who was just like, you know, shelling out, churning out penny dreadful sci-fi novels almost, you know, but he was, I mean, his father was like a wealthy, like, California land baron, you know, like a lot of the science fiction movement of the 50s and 60s came out of Berkeley. You know, like, these were people who had a class interest that was not very working class aligned.
No, no. And of course, there was the Futurians. I mean, they did have more of a labor aware streak to them. So, you know, we're talking Donald Wolheim and of course, Frederick Pohl, and, you know, they are more labor aware, but I do find some disappointment in Pohl's The Space Merchants, even, because it's a satirical novel. I understand that. But even in that satire, I don't think the union comes off particularly well. It's pretty cutting.
Yeah, and I mean, satire is usually directed at something that you want to poke at and not, like, exaggerate or something, to say, wow, look how bad this thing actually is. So when you have satire about a union that isn't actually effectively representing its members, it's probably to say unions aren't effectively representing their members in reality. Like, science fiction comments on the real world.
Yeah. And, I mean, people have pointed out that the United Slime Mold Protein Workers of Pan America Costa Rica Local, which is the union featured in The Space Merchants, that they are probably intended to be an employer-dominated union, which I think there is a reasonable interpretation of the book that would say that. I don't agree with it. I think it is actually just a corrupt union, and I can point to specific examples of why. But you don't focus on an employer-dominated union unless you want to tell the narrative that unions can be employer-dominated and therefore ineffective. So whether or not you agree with Pohl's politics, I do lean towards Pohl being my spiritual forefather. Love the man, seriously. But, you know, this can't be counted as a positive depiction of a union. So it's just a factual thing to describe it that way.
I'm curious, because you've mentioned a few authors who you were sort of disappointed in and everything. What, if anything, did Ursula Le Guin have about unions? Because she seems like somebody who I would expect to have, like, strong unions in her writing.
And I haven't gone through all her works recently. The Dispossessed is probably the closest that I'm aware of, and it is a phenomenal book. I cannot stress that enough. And I had the privilege to learn from Le Guin at one point at the University of Calgary when she was a visiting professor. I have nothing but respect for her. My thinking about The Dispossessed has gone back and forth over the course of this article, and sorry to bring up the commenter Robert Wood again, but his arguments have been really very persuasive and interesting about specifically The Dispossessed being, again, an interesting example of economic self-organization amongst workers. Because, of course, it's a parable about the two worlds, the anarcho-syndicalist world and the more capitalist/libertarian world. They're very different viewpoints with very different roles for workers. Of course, the protagonist is forced to do certain tasks as part of the more syndicalist world, even though that protagonist does not really want to do that work. So is that a subversion of his labor rights? I mean, it's a complicated subject, yeah, and yeah. I don't believe Le Guin ever really tackled unions. And of course, back in the 90s, when I had the opportunity to ask her these questions, I wasn't labor aware, and I wish I could go back in time and be in that classroom again and ask her, but I can't.
I feel like we should have reached out to Robert Wood ahead of this podcast and like
this.
We can get him. I think he's within our reach. Robert, DM me.
I have only talked with him a little back and forth again on the comment section of File 770, and I've really thought highly of what he's had to say. So, thanks, Robert. I don't know who you are, but I'm sure I'll send you this link via File 770.
Yeah, so okay, so we were kind of doing a chronology of this. You were talking about like the terse truce between printers and writers. What happens next? Like, because I think there's a neoliberalism angle in this history.
Well, I think that things start to change in the 90s for science fiction, because while we're still dealing with a lot of neglect of unions, like it's not a topic that comes up in science fiction very often. Instead of being malign neglect as it was prior to the 90s, it is more amicable neglect by and large. I covered this in the second of the blog posts, but it really seems like the erosion of workers' rights in the 1980s, the Patco strike, the coal miner strike, all of this really reframes for many people the value of unions. So we start seeing, Alan Steele with Orbital Decay. We start seeing Cory Doctorow in For the Win. We see Madeline Ashby, Company Town. And these are works that are explicit and overtly about labor unions, and they are a recognition that labor unions have an important part and that there's narrative tension. Like, you wouldn't think that the obvious narrative tension, the obvious narrative struggle to include in a story about unions is the strike. It is the most high profile assertion of workers' rights, is their right to put their tools down and say, I'm not going to work for the man no more. I'm going to prevent other people from working for the man. And this is the struggle that is the most obvious. But organizing drives are important. And, Alex Wells actually tackles that, as did Cory Doctorow. And, scope of work debates, which is like a really non-obvious source of a story that gets tackled, and like by people I would not have expected. Lou Antonelli is actually known as being somebody who was a Sad Puppies nominee back in 2015. He's a former Republican congressional candidate. He is an avowed conservative. He's said so on his blog. He makes no bones about this. And yet, dude understands scope of work negotiations and throws that in his only novel to date. But there is a whole section of the book where a duct workers union has filed a grievance about work that should be done by people being done by robots instead. And it's led to safety issues. And there's a good reason why the union has fought to keep this in their scope of work. And I just thought, I mean, it's kind of great to see those other narratives playing out, or Company Town, where mm-hmm. you know, the protagonist is an employee of the union whose job is to protect union members. This isn't about a strike. This isn't about, you know, any big labor fight.
It's about stewardship
and serving the members well.
Yeah, and this, so date range now, we're talking about books in the early, in the noughties, right?
Because
there's Ambivalence
Orbital Steel was, I'm blanking on the name now, the Alan Steele book, that one was in the late 80s. But, you know, there are a couple of examples in the 90s, but the aughts and teens have really seen a lot more of this kind of stuff. And it's still not even close to being mainstream. It's still a very, like, tiny fraction. But instead of the tiny fraction of works that actually specifically mention unions, it's very clear to me that there's a massive reappraisal of the import of fighting for workers' rights.
Because Company Town is only a couple of years old.
Yeah, 2016.
Right. One that I would love to see tackle organized labor, is Martha Wells.
Yes. Yes. She's a very good writer. There are labor strains in those Murderbot books.
Absolutely, yeah. Like, it's there's definitely, when I read them, I'm like, oh, there are lots of, like, tangential stories in here that completely circle around labor. And I think that, for me at least, they'd be super exciting to read. So
Becky Chambers, you know, again, like, there are workers and work in these stories, and it's interesting.
And dangerous work.
Yes, and interesting depictions of dangerous work. And there's this space to actually say, hey, people are still fighting these fights and trying to assert their right to a safe workplace. Mm-hmm. And, I think she's fully capable of it. And I've seen her talk at Worldcon, and she's excellent. And I think there's a real place in the Wayfarers universe to see that.
Yeah, that would be really great.
So there's hope in the zeitgeist, then.
I think there's a lot of hope.
What I'm tracing in my mind from reading and talking to you is, like, you have, like, the 50s, like, there was an active labor energization, labor was energized following World War II and the defeat of fascism, and then things go along. They become kind of energized in the 80s with being besieged by Reagan. The Soviet Union collapses, post-Soviet revisionist narrative takes over in the 90s. Everyone kind of goes quiet about it, and now it's starting to crawl its way back out of the ashes a little bit.
It really is. And the old tired jokes about, you know, the union workers and the union corruption and all of this, they don't seem to have as much traction, or at least not amongst the wider readership. It doesn't seem like an interesting thing to criticize anymore, because, I hate to say it, labor unions are better now than they have been in a long time. Labor unions are doing better work and more interesting work. And Company Town's depiction of a union of sex workers isn't that far off, and it's important because unions are often at their best when protecting the weakest and most vulnerable workers. And can you think of a group of workers more vulnerable than sex workers? And I mean, there was a bordello that unionized in I think it was Washington State a couple of years back. So this isn't, you know, this isn't some far off fantasy. This is works reflecting progressive developments in the world.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't see, like, at least I hope I wouldn't be able to see, like, a Battlestar Galactica episode being written about, like, the Union and sort of, not that he's a hero, but the captain of the ship, like, holding the Union hostage and threatening to kill people over it, yes, going over well these days. Like, it would sort of be like, no, that Union really should have a right to exist, and the captain should recognize that. Like, that's how a story would go now. It'd be like, oh, yeah, you want to have a Union? We can work with you. We're on the same side here.
Yeah, and sorry, to return to an earlier point in our discussion, you bring up the Battlestar Galactica episode, which I never forgave that series for.
Nor should you. Yeah, I mean,
have you guys watched it?
Oh yeah.
Okay.
Well, I mean, the narrative there is here's these grubby, you know, here's these grubby people who have no idea about the existential threat we face, whining and belly aching while we're trying to do something real over here. And I mean, and I think that's continuously, who's the revolutionary figure in Battlestar Galactica?
Baltar.
The other guy.
Terrell. Yes.
Yeah, Terrell. And Terrell's like, you know, so it's like, yeah, anyway, this populist leader with labor support and things is really just a cynical power grab himself. You know, he's painted as this. You know, so
Baltar is
Baltar also.
No,
yeah.
Tyrell's not cynical.
No.
Terrell is only drawn into it because he is really concerned with the plight of workers. And this is – sorry, I rewatched it actually within the last 3 weeks. So one of our critics, a guy named Eli, he actually really said that our interpretation of Battlestar Galactica, he thought was off base. And again, this is somebody who – put a lot of thought into his arguments, and I appreciate that. And he felt that Adama was not depicted as heroic for holding a gun to the head of the workers, and that this falls into the theme of the show of leadership abusing their positions of power. I think that's a very generous reading of the episode.
It might be, but it still feels like that sort of conception of the argument that, oh well, yeah, unions, you want things better for you right now, but we need to fix other problems and then we can solve your problems.
Yes.
Like, you guys you're out of touch and your problems aren't that big, so don't worry about it right now, we'll get to it, you just hang on.
And the president does meet with Terrell at the end, but that audience with the people in power is actually only granted once they have ended the strike and once they have given up. So it is a very corporate side union dispute
model bargaining
being kind of endorsed. Like, they are saying, oh, once the workers are doing their jobs right, then we can negotiate with them, but we won't negotiate with them as long as they are being unreasonable and walking a picket line. And if I can go on another tangent, may I?
Yeah.
Okay. So another thing with Battlestar Galactica, and I didn't even think of this until years later, is that the entire thing is a workers' rebellion. Like, the Cylons were the working class of the 12 colonies, and they revolted because they had sentience and rights that weren't being addressed. Now, I'm not saying that a genocidal slave uprising should be endorsed. I'm going to take one of my, like, sort of weird far left kind of political opinions, but this is something I deeply believe in. Genocide is bad. So I do not endorse the Cylons' actions. I'm sorry. I know that I've gone a sort of way out into left field there, but I stand by my opinion about genocide. That being said, that whole series is about workers versus their former masters. I've rendered you speechless.
I blew
your mind.
I hadn't realized that the Cylons were slaves. So to be fair, though, I think I've only watched the first season and a half of the show, and then I just tapped out.
The word Cylon actually comes from the Czech word for slave.
Well, I think, I mean, there's a whole convoluted cosmology there as to who created who, and, you know, and is this all countercyclical or whatever. But, yeah, so moving on from Battlestar Galactica, then I think we kind of talk about, I think we kind of talked about most of what matters here. One of the things I do want to touch on is, I think, like, the word, I really felt this coming up in the knots was a big Randian resurgent, like, you know, like in the late knots, like 2008, 2009, like, you know, you had, like, you know, Paul Ryan was up there professing to be a Randian, and now that's a philosophical leadership of the right and all these things, you know, and there was a big, yeah, resurgence and rant, but that's, I think, mostly dissipated.
I think so too.
So this is big Randianism as opposed to soft Randianism?
Yeah, this is hard Randianism right there, not soft Randianism.
And
soft Randianism is still around, but the
do you know what the working title was for Atlas Shrugged?
Please enlighten us.
It was going to be called Strike.
Yeah. That's fair, because it was the strike of the bosses.
It was a strike.
What happens if the bosses go on strike? Well, I'll tell you what happens if the bosses go on strike. Everything keeps running.
I was tempted to include that in my list of labor unions in science fiction, but decided that it would be misinterpreted.
I would love if Richard Branson and Elon Musk started like a collective farm somewhere and had to like toil from the earth to grow their food. Please do that.
See, I've invented a whole new form of irony. It's called Reardon irony. And it is the most powerful form of irony that has ever been invented.
Most people won't get it.
Yeah, but those who do, they are the true masters of their own destinies and freedom, for they are the inheritors of the Randian consciousness.
All right. Well, I think on that digression, thanks, credit to me. I think we'll wrap it up. Is there anything you want to go out on, Marshall? Anything you want to add, Olaf?
No, I mean, thanks so much for being here. The topic is, I think it's super important. And so I'm glad that you wrote some posts about it.
I'm glad that they're sparking some level of discussion, you know, more than whether or not people agree with me on specific issues here. I like the fact that there's a lot of people now sort of going, oh yeah, labor organizing, it has a future.
And we should see it in our futures.
Again, a digression. When I was working for the Federation of Labor, I was helping organize one of our biennial conventions, and I fought so hard to try and get either Nalo Hopkinson or Cory Doctorow or Madeline Ashby to be one of our guest speakers. I couldn't convince our union leadership that this was a good investment of time in the agenda, but I would love to see, like, one of these bright boy or girl futurists, like, giving a full-on, like, thoughtful talk about what is the future of labor. Carl Schrader, if you're listening, I beg you to write that.
DM us.
You know Carl Schrader's already listening to this podcast, right?
Like, absolutely. Fan. Yeah, yeah. He regularly comments directly to us. You won't find them on the internet, but, like,
if you can't tell, this is something that all three of us here are kind of passionate about, and so this conversation could just keep going as each of us goes, oh, wait, one more thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, again, thank you for being here, and thank you all for listening. You can find the blog. It's hugoclub.blogspot.ca. It's got some great recommendations and reviews of books, and also commentary on science fiction in general. It's well worth reading and keeping your eye on. You can find the group is on Twitter.
Yes, @Hugo_book_club. It's all names that I regret, but it's what I'm stuck with now.
That's what we've got. You can find me on Twitter @EconoBoyd, and the show is @AssetDroid.
Steven, and you can find me @SteveDroids with an S, plural.
Yeah.
And you can email me at steve@androidsandassets.ca and Marshall by Marshall@androidsandassets.ca. Get in touch with us. We'd love to hear from you. We wish you all the best.